This is The Main Course on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, with my partner in crime, the one and only...
Patrick Martins.
Don't be shy, Patrick.
Hey, everybody. Yeah, I know. I'm accused
Patrick
of being shy.
Patrick is like, you have no idea, people, what a dynamo this guy is. He is really extraordinary. So yesterday, Patrick, let's talk about what we did yesterday. We went to Pat LaFrieda's warehouse.
In New Jersey, and we basically added ice packs and inserts into...
And checked... Each and every turkey that is going out of Pat LaFrieda's warehouse, which was 880, just in case you were wondering.
And then they were doing a couple thousand out of Kansas City. Yeah. What we did is we zone hopped, which is basically called, it's not stealing, but it's like definitely taking advantage of FedEx because they charge by zone. And so if you ship everything from Kansas City to the coast, which is where most of our accounts are, you're shipping about six zones. But we trucked some birds. We trucked 800 turkeys to New York so that we could send to New York and in that immediate area from New York. So we were only shipping one or two zones.
Yes, that was very smart of you.
Yet they were still there and they brought us donuts.
I know, they were awesome. FedEx people are so great. Well, you know, they understand that they need to keep the business going. Otherwise, they're losing a valuable client. I mean, as you pointed out, you ship quite a bit with FedEx. So
how do you think the turkeys looked?
I thought they looked awesome. They looked like real turkeys. And I think that it's, you know, that's kind of unusual. I mean, most people are used to the butterball variety with the giant puffy breast and the super white slick skin. And they're all juiced up with saline. And, you know, they're fine if that's what you want, but these are real birds. They're a little on the slenderer side, a little longer.
Well, they have a longer breastbone.
Feathers still, because defeathering is not, especially on our kosher birds, and you are the only company in the country who is offering certified kosher heritage breed turkeys.
But of course, they don't use hot water, which is...
That's against the laws of kashrut.
And hot water, you know, hitting the dead carcass is how feathers come off.
Yeah.
So especially with heritage turkeys, it becomes a problem with commodity turkeys, but especially with heritage turkeys who are known for having pin feathers, you know, it makes it a little
And also dark feathers, which makes it more obvious.
Yeah, so it does have a little somewhat of a tattooed appearance, and, you know, that was a little weird, but, you know, at the same time, we stand by the markets we try to push open, and there were a lot of Jewish people who couldn't try heritage turkeys because they weren't kosher, and we felt that they deserved to be part of the market, even with all the headaches, and we'll work with the slaughterhouse, and... You know, and basically, why do we fight all these fights? I mean, sometimes I ask myself, why the hell do I go crazy every Thanksgiving? And, you know, and really, this is true, and it's part of an email we're going to write. You know, we kind of want to announce to mega companies, and this radio is a big part of that, because we're kind of creating our own media source for these ideas. You know, we're kind of announcing that we want to kind of fiercely grow until these mega companies come to the table to discuss bettering the lot of the animals they rely on for profits.
That's what it's all about. You know,
They have to be fair. You know, they can't make too many profits, but on the backs of unhealthy and abused animals. I mean, if you can't walk or roost as a turkey,
you're not a happy turkey.
Yeah, you've removed their ability to enact their God-given instincts. That's like deeply wrong. And we're really psyched this year. We're in Emory University again and now Virginia Tech. So, you know, we're doing their Christmas and Thanksgivings there. So that's a, you know.
Those are big markets to open up. And that's an important demographic to include in the whole sort of heritage message, which is, you know, younger people who are much more inclined to pay attention to their food choices.
And I want to thank Jack for putting the ice packs and pork chops, especially in the kosher birds. Thank you, Jack.
It was amazing how many kosher birds got pork chops. That was hilarious. But that's because kosher birds can be very tasty thanks to their excellent brining. They all get soaked in a salt solution.
So we have Mary Cleaver, who is kind of like, you know, I don't
know. Personal icon.
Personal icon, you know, part of New York City food history, you know, and she'd been doing this probably.
She's not that old.
No, but I mean.
But you do have one of the oldest catering companies probably in the city. And I, you know, the strange thing is that Mary Cleaver was crazy enough to hire me as a prep cook way back when I was like in my early 20s and just
before
starting
being
out.
A butcher or after?
Yeah, way before. I mean, like, I really didn't know anything. It was like very, very generous of her to hire me and put up with my nonsense. And did my friend Alaric Valentin work with us too?
Yes.
Would you like sniff like dust off in the bathroom and stuff and eat glue and all that? I mean, were you really immature?
Almost that bad.
Oh,
yeah.
No.
Certainly very immature in my approach to work. I can certainly promise you that.
Did you get fired?
Not from Mary. No, she's way too nice.
She had Emilio fire you?
I got fired by tons of other people, though, at the time. Emilio. And I quit.
Emilio was only 2 years old when...
That's right.
Yeah, it was a crazy time. I was just learning how to work then. I don't think I had started working for Michel Guitton at that, or maybe I had, but anyway, yeah, I was just learning the trade. And Mary, I remember, showed me how to do chauffeur, which is a really old-fashioned French preparation. It was like a poached chicken breast. Everything was poached then.
Chauffeur or foie?
Foie.
Foie.
So hot, cold?
Yeah, hot, cold sauce. And it's basically mayonnaise in which you dissolve some gelatin and thin it out with that. And then you pour it in layers. And Mary was doing these unbelievably beautiful poached chicken breasts with a chauffeur and then some incredible design of, you know, red peppers and chives.
It was a wedding, I think, at the New York. At the New York Botanical Gardens.
Wow. Yeah. So that was, I never forget that, actually. Yeah.
And have that you whole made chauffeur since?
I did make it several times after that. I must say mine never looked quite as shiny and beautiful as yours did, because, you know, whatever.
Well, that's that'd be an appropriate sauce for that massive house you have in Rhode Island, hot and cold. You know, like right. If you're by the heater, it's like 100 degrees.
Yeah.
It's like 10 degrees.
Assuming the heater
else.
Is working, I've noticed some problems.
Katie has like a Miss Havisham house.
Yes, it's the house I grew up in, Mary.
So we
I
should mention our, Sims. We're going to have Mary on.
We're going to have Mary on in a second. And let's wrap up the conclusion. I'm going to give our sponsor a great big shout out.
Who's our Chicago guest?
And then we're going to have Liz Grossberger from Chicago. She's the managing editor of Plate Magazine.
And that's part of our series of going to different cities and learning about their food culture.
Yeah, exactly. And getting the down and low on whatever cities.
Someone once, William Rice told me, he was a important journalist for the Chicago Tribune for a long time. He was like, the sustainable food movement's never hit Chicago. We're literally like decades behind because in Chicago, when people, it's like Wednesday night and they're like, we're going out Friday night, they're thinking steak because it's just such a big thing. So it's been very hard for other cuisines and nouveau this or that to grow in that city. Anyway, I just thought it was an interesting observation. I'd like to ask her about
that. Well, it is interesting. And I think also the, you know, it's a meatpackers town.
Yeah.
And
exactly.
Always has been. And even though they don't do a lot of it anymore, it still has that kind of ethos. But without further ado, let us announce our sponsor for today's show, and that is Cabot Cheese. And Cabot Cheese suggests that for holiday recipes, let the great taste of Cabot Cheese make them even more special. Award-winning Cabot Cheese donates 100% of their profits to New England and New York's farm families. It's a cooperative.
Yeah, it's
a dairy
amazing.
Cooperative. It's fantastic. On the web at cabotcheese.com. And for your favorite party recipes, let the great taste of Cabot Cheese make them even more special. We can talk about that with you, Mary. Award-winning Cabot Cheese has been owned since 1919 by a Vermont dairy farm family. Oh, it's been a cooperative since 1919 and is proud to have been voted your four-time champion cheddar. And it is really great.
I would like to say about Cabot, I love one thing about them more than any. They are successful. You know, and we're about to talk to Mary, who's an entrepreneur, you know, and who has a business. I mean, to be in the world of business and not in the realm of nonprofits and just mission through talking, but mission through doing is absolutely something the network believes in. So applause to Cabot, and we'll take a break.
And we'll be right back with Mary Cleaver of the Cleaver Company.
Because Pharaoh's on it. Don't you know that in singing Mary,
oh, Mary, don't you
tell Martha not to moan.
Martha, don't you moan.
We'll singing Mary,
oh, Mary, don't you
tell Martha not to moan.
Martha, don't you moan.
Well, Mary,
Mary,
yeah, tell Martha not to moan.
Martha, don't you moan.
'Cause Pharaoh's on
Pharaoh's
it. Don't you know that I've been drowned? Saying Mary,
oh, Mary, don't you
tell Martha not to moan.
Martha, don't you moan.
One more time, singing if
I could.
I believe that I would.
I should.
I'm gonna stand up.
This is is the main course on Heritage Radio Network. We're located in the back of Roberta's Restaurant at 261 Moore Street in Brooklyn. I am your host, Katie Kiefer, with my partner in crime, Patrick Martins. And our guest today is Mary Cleaver of the Cleaver Company. Welcome, Mary. Thanks so much for coming out here and bringing your beautiful daughter, Emma. It's nice to see you.
Emma, you're welcome to, like, yeah, if your mother says something outrageous.
Jump in, girl. No problem. We'll have to get you another mimosa.
So Mary Cleaver has an unbelievable shop in the Chelsea Market, which is, I want to ask you about public markets later and all that, but it's a place where people can eat. In fact, there's a big, beautiful dining room table, a wood table that graces the hall of Chelsea Market.
It's a full-blown restaurant.
Yeah, no, it's
called the Green Table.
Full bore, yeah.
And then, but you also bring your restaurant to other places through a catering company. So you do, I know, important events around the country, right?
I've been in the catering business for a long time, as Katie mentioned earlier, over 30 years. And I started from my five-flight walk-up on Mulberry Street when I moved to New York, deciding that I wouldn't be able to start a farm and make goat cheese in Vermont because I didn't have any capital to do that with. So I came to New York and started washing dishes. And
where did you do that?
I did that at a fancy takeout shop on the Upper East Side called EAT.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. That's still there.
I worked with Eli Zabar for 6 months.
He was a tough cookie.
That seems like long enough.
It was a long time. I saw many people come and go in that period.
But he also pays his people very well, I hear, or, you know, seen
he
Lippert
has some
and
real
Mona
long-term
Talbot.
Employees now, actually. There's people there that I've seen, I saw from because I used to work across the street from it, and I go in there quite often.
Well, I hear that on his second marriage and having children, he became a much more human being.
Yeah.
And we were not allowed to sit down for 12 hours.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, wow. Labor laws and Eli's.
It was before the days of good shoes, you know.
Yeah,
and so I just would come home and just be in agony. My standing up for 12 hours on a hard floor was a change.
Well, my mother says the EAT, that old baker, you know, who basically was the muscle behind that famous baguette, which was at every deli in the city, and it was basically the first fresh bread that anyway we knew on the Upper East Side. It was that long, it looked almost burnt facel. They had an onion one and a plain one. And that guy passed away, like, at the oven. I mean, he was working, like, 20-hour days. So,
probably.
It was definitely very hard.
Never allowed to sit down. I'm not surprised he croaked.
I learned a lot about cheese at working for Eli. Wonderful, wonderful cheeses. And it was a curious time. When I moved to New York, I didn't understand why you couldn't find local produce in anywhere in New York City.
Well, where did you come from that
and
you
yet,
could?
Well, I grew up in the Northeast, New Jersey, southeastern Massachusetts, Vermont. I was in Vermont for 7 years before I came to New York, where I went to college. But also, at that year working at Eli's, it was the first time that raspberries arrived from Chile in February. And so you couldn't get tomatoes in August that were grown in New Jersey, but you could get raspberries from Chile in February.
That must have been just the beginning of international shipping.
The beginning of the end. No, also the beginning of the beginning of trying to get sustainable local food
I don't remember even thinking, I'm sorry to talk over you, but I don't even remember thinking about that stuff because it was such a gas to get these exotics in the off-season months and to have access to so much different types of produce and fruits.
Yeah.
You know, it just was like, that was, who thought about the food miles that they traveled or the, you know, the impact? Mary was thinking about it. Emma says Mary was thinking about it.
I was thinking about it.
Now, let me ask, what was the landscape for you thinking about this? I mean, there's this romantic view that in the past things were more sustainable or nutritious or more local or something like that. Like, but then on the other side, we've heard people say, like, in the 70s, like, everyone was going to the Greek coffee shops and it was just bad French fries and bad meat in the hamburgers. Like, was it sustainable? Like, what was the foodscape like in the 70s for New Yorkers?
Well, you know, I'm really probably not the best person to ask that question because I just arrived into New York in the late 70s. But what I was looking for were quality ingredients to cook with. And for me, it had always been a seasonal, cooking had been a seasonal experience. So, and I had always cooked with food that was from the area and, you know, loved the apples when it was apple season and loved the cherries when it was cherry season. But you know, in the way we work now at the Cleaver Company and the Green Table, we don't, if something grows here, we don't use it unless it's in season. But people have been moving food around the world forever and ever and ever, and it's, you know, what a lot of our global economy is based on. So I'm glad we can have olive oil and chocolate and mangoes. Mm-hmm. And
people had been shipping products throughout history. I mean, in ancient Rome, I mean, things were going all over the place.
All the olive oil came from Spain, the hills of Rome, or the amphores, broken amphores. Of, you know, it came in. So,
but Mary, when did, because you have made being sort of green a centerpiece of your business model for like, at least 15, 20 years. Like that's been a big marketing, part of your marketing. And when did you like get to realize, because you were way ahead of the curve on this, I think.
Well, as I said, I mean, it's just what I had always done as a child. Yeah. And so I just kept doing it. But it was difficult because, green markets actually changed everything. So once I discovered Green Market.
Which started right then too, right? 78?
Kind of. Yeah.
79?
Yeah. So
on the 59th Street Bridge?
That was the first one, and then Union Square the next year, and ever since. And now they're over 50.
Oh, yeah.
And it's an amazing organization.
Is that where you did your strategic, your tactical maneuvering? Was that those first farmer markets?
Yeah, that's where I started, met farmers and made, began relationships.
And who were those farmers, and which of them are still around?
Well, some of them are still at the market. Some of them are not at the market any longer, but we still work with, like Guy Jones at Blooming Hill. Mm-hmm. The Stokes Farms still there. There are actually quite a few.
So they've stayed? I mean, most of those farms I worked with in 79 or 80 are still there
today.
Been
straight through Hodgson, yeah. But of course, then there are lots and lots of new ones, too, all the time.
What about protein? What about meats?
Well, meats start...
That must have been much harder.
Much harder. And actually, it was really after the trade towers fell that I became... Anyway, to answer your former question, I mean, the more I learned about the food... The more I worked in food, the more I learned about how scary the food supply was. And so I became more and more and more in need of knowing where all of my food came from, because I wanted to be giving my clients healthy food, for one thing, and also to be, having a positive effect on the food supply and trying to create a better environment for all of us, right? Having children does sort of put that future scope, gets you thinking about the seventh generation,
Yeah. So it's not selfish for your own taste while you're...
Well, of course, the taste is a big part of it, too. And really just food that has a high water content tastes better, much closer to the source.
Does that intimidate you that your mom dedicated her whole life to bettering the world for after she was gone? Huge responsibility
for your benefit,
on your shoulders,
do you feel
to
guilty?
Be nice to her?
She is incredibly impassioned about what she does, and I've grown up with it my entire life, has been, watching her work on this. It really is a mission for her, and, having grown up with it, I don't really know anything else, and it makes total sense to me.
Right.
So, I mean, I think it's great, and we eat good food.
Well.
We eat good food, and we know where it comes from, and even when I went to college, I still was concerned about where my food was coming from, and that was, it's a lifestyle.
For our viewers out there, they're very healthy. Mary and her daughter look very,
they both have very,
very
pink
healthy
cheeks.
So the meat, Green Markets did bring in, did a great job of getting produce into the marketplace of New York City, and the first meat producer I met was just in the fall of 2001. Jen Small and Mike Yezzi from Flying Pigs Farm turned up at my local Borough Hall Green Market in Brooklyn. And I was really excited to see them there. And they are from Shushan, which is near Bennington, where I lived and went to college in North Bennington. And so they were surprised that I knew the area. Anyway, after the towers fell, the Cleaver Company was very fortunate to be hired by St. Paul's Church to prepare 200 dinners a night.
Oh, wow.
And, what happened immediately after the towers fell was that we had this sort of reverse in the food chain of New York, where City Harvest was actually bringing raw product to us, to our kitchen, to prepare, to turn into prepared food to take out then to the peers and things. So
to the workers, yeah.
So they, so we were working with City Harvest closely, and as the year went by, City Harvest was given grants by the National Pork Board and the National Beef Board, $3,000 and $5,000 respectively, and they gave it to me to use for the work at St. Paul's. So I thought, well, okay, can I use it with small producers in upstate New York? And, you know, there was no objection to that from City Harvest. So right. I took the money and ran to Washington County and, you know, sort of helped... Help Flying Pigs, you know, it was the biggest order they'd ever had, you know. Sure. So, and it was, and then I found a beef producer in named Mike Scannell, Harrier Field Farm, and he, you know, was growing his beef, you know, farming his land, 60 acres, with horses. I mean, he was a real Wendell Berry advocate, a very, very pure grower and producer, and, you know, lived in very. I took the kids actually with me up there, and they grew up in the city. They'd seen a lot of urban poverty, but they hadn't seen rural poverty. I mean, they were making $15,000 a year, and I just realized it's my job. I'm a jobber. I need to get this product, this local product, into the marketplace. So that's. I started talking with Jen about it, and we eventually started a company called Farm to Chef, which was a not for profit. Started with a grant from New York State Department of Ag and Markets. To bring local produce and animal proteins into the marketplace of New York City.
So to describe Field to Chef, I mean, how does that organization work?
Well, it started out, we worked with the Cornell Extension rep in Washington and Saratoga counties, Paula Schaefer, and she was a wonderful person. And so she gathered, we had a big meeting up at Chez Sophie, outside of Saratoga, and one February with all, she's, you know, invited all the producers. We had three counties, Washington, Saratoga, and Rensselaer, who wanted to come and learn about it and think about it. And there were some farmers who were very skeptical, you know, we've tried this sort of thing before, it'll never work. And there were others who were said, you know, very positive, let's give it a try. We had an apple producer, a pork producer, a beef producer, eggs. And then we did sort of the same thing in the city. I gathered a whole group of chefs that I thought might be like-minded and interested in doing this at the Green Table, and we had a, you know, brought samples down. And anyway, it started out with a list. The producers would list what they had available that week. The chefs would get the list on a Friday, and on Monday you'd place your order, and on Tuesday the producers took it all to a central spot, and Wednesday it came down to the city and was distributed.
Yeah. Was how did you solve that distribution and processing piece of the puzzle, seems to be the biggest roadblock?
Well, distribution is a huge, huge problem, and yeah. We have a lot of infrastructure that needs to be recreated in the Hudson Valley and in the New York area, and I mean, Patrick knows. I mean, processing slaughterhouses is a big part of the. Part of the
processing, I mean, distribution it has become a huge hurdle. What it is, it's a guy driving a truck, girl or a guy driving a truck.
But it's got to be somebody who's willing to drive less than load, like Cannonball, right?
Right, it doesn't matter. But yeah, it's a guy driving a truck. I mean, if another September 11th happened and we need to figure out, it would take 20 minutes to figure out the distribution problem. So I don't want to make distribution to all those people out there being like, oh, should I start an entrepreneurial business? Yes, drive this stuff there yourself for a year or two. If it's successful and is growing, the next solution will come. But the processing is more complicated. And by the way, that too, for someone like Paradise Locker Meats, they're like, yeah, it's a pain in the butt to start a processing plant, but you know, we could have one. I mean, if they were paid $1 million, they would come and open one for the state of New York in 3 months that worked perfectly. So, I mean, that too. But that also involves a lot more money and people and employees and insurance and USDA. But
yeah.
And so that is very complicated. But it's also not brain science. I mean, we land men on the moon. We can open a slaughterhouse.
But nobody wants to.
Well, right, that's it. It's investors don't want to give the money, I think, is the biggest problem. They're scared.
And towns don't want them.
Towns don't want processing plants, or slaughterhouses. Yeah, even if they're right outside of town.
And also, it's so exciting to see the skill coming back. You know, people interested in being butchers. I mean, I was at the Brooklyn Kitchen last night where they have, you know, we have Jake Dixon in the Chelsea Market. I mean, it's really exciting that it used to be, you know, the Jefferson Market was where I went for
the. And there was Nevada Meats on the Upper West Side. Yeah. And then later there was Broadway Butcher.
Yeah.
And there was, what's his name? Harry Oppenheimer.
Right.
And we had quite a few butchers on the Upper West Side.
No, there were, but.
But they all went away.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Ottomanelli's.
The Ottomanelli's brothers, who I stopped by.
And there's Florence still downtown.
Yeah.
But that's about it. It's it's still, I mean, I still feel like even though it's really trendy right now to love meat and be interested in it and all the DIY classes and stuff, there still aren't really
well, there's that many a difference shops. Between the DIY butcher movement and, you know, getting every single available acre in the state of New York to be processing efficiently and be delivering into the city. I mean, hopefully that DIY movement will lead to that, because that's really what's needed, is that there's very few farmers and very few slaughterhouses. I mean, this needs to be more than just an individual. Somehow all these individual stars need to come together in a constellation and work on a common mission, which you started.
But it is encouraging to see a whole generation coming up now. I mean, you can be, for example, you know, now you can be an urban farmer. You can live in New York and be a farmer, you know.
Yes, as Ben Flanner will attest, outside at the Brooklyn Grange right now.
Yeah, it's our last day at the Brooklyn Grange. So they have hot sauces and jams, you know, things
they
to
have
get you
microgreens,
through the spring.
Unbelievable baby spinach, baby carrots, baby beets. Chard, beautiful rainbow chard.
Will you make a salad with your vegetables for our viewers to be able to watch?
Our listeners,
you can give a technique. No, just, I love it. So
the sound of the tongs
you're
against
like,
the bowl.
Everyone, do it like this. Cut the carrots like this. Wait, don't do it like that. Cut it like this. Scratch everything I just said. So we're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back. I want to ask you a little bit about some of the history of New York's sustainable food movement, you know, within, you know, Peter Hoffman. I know you were starting with people of that ilk.
But also where it's going next and what we can build on from here.
Public markets. And I want to also know a little bit about catering, like people in the
Oh, we got to talk
country,
catering, man. We got to.
How do people navigate what's a good caterer, what's a bad? How does one judge catering? It's. Everyone seems to be doing it, but very few people seem to be doing it well. So it's interesting to unpack that whole world. So
absolutely. So we'll be back in 1 minute with Mary Cleaver.
The New England and New York farm families who own Cabot Cooperative are offering listeners a chance to win some of the world's best cheddar simply by calling into the show at 718-497-2128. Or emailing us at info@heritageradionetwork.com. What a great way to start the holidays. I'll be picking a winner for the program about 1 week from now. Cabot Creamery is a proud supporter of what Heritage Radio is all about.
This is The Main Course on Heritage Radio Network. This is Katie Kiefer with my co-host Patrick Martins.
Sometimes you pause so that I have to say my own name.
I know, but sometimes you don't pick it up that fast.
I can never predict which one you're going to
Maybe
do.
I should give you a secret signal. Like,
ooh, we didn't do our shot of Fernet Branca.
I know, and I miss it. But fortunately, the Bloody Mary has gone directly to my head, so it's okay.
So can you tell...
Wait. Oh, we have Mary Cleaver in the studio. Mary is the proprietress of the Green Table at the Chelsea Market and also the owner of the Cleaver Company, which is one of the longest-running catering businesses in New York. You've been in business for over 30 years. Mary and I met about 30-something years ago when I was a prep cook for her when she was operating illegally out of her loft on Franklin Street.
That's right. I had insurance, but not a Department of Health certification.
Yeah.
I'm sure you'd have gotten an A.
We got an A this week.
Oh, they were very
Katie's
exciting.
Idea is that everyone is getting an A, or Anne's. I forget who. Someone
not
told
me.
Everyone is getting an A this first go around to kind of like
just to
remove the
them.
Stress from, oh my God, I got a C. But then next year it's going to be much harder.
Well, we were told we had the cleanest ice machine in New York City, so...
Wow, and that's saying something.
The things
water
that,
can
know,
be so dirty.
Yeah,
Well, what can get in there? It can be pretty funky.
That's true. You want to be drinking it. Yeah,
for sure.
So, so what was your? We wanted to ask a couple of questions before we got to the catering world.
Well, one thing was, Mary, we were talking earlier about how you started the field to chef program,
farm to chef. Yeah,
farm to chef, and then let's build on that for a second and talk a little bit about how going from that sort of ethos in your own work that you've had that same philosophy about food for all these many years, and what's the difference been between say selling that concept in the 80s and 90s and selling it today? Because you were saying there was quite a big change.
Yeah,
there.
I guess from my perspective, the important thing about cooking is you need to have the best possible ingredients. So if you don't start with the best ingredients, how can you end up with something quality?
Really good? Yeah.
So that's always been my approach to food, find the best possible ingredients. And as I said, I grew up always using local seasonal food. So, and when I was 10, I had the great opportunity to go to France and live in Paris for the summer and go to the markets and really learn about how it worked there. And so that was always my idea of the best food.
Yes.
And anyway, so
it does make
a
big impression when you're young to see that. It really does.
Done it. And it's not something that the world really wanted to know about. Back up. I think that we really didn't understand as a culture in America how awful our food supply had become. And it became more and more corporate and more removed from actual food and more involved with poisons and bad growing practices. And, so the more I learned about the food supply, the more I realized that I really wanted to stick to my guns and really know where the food came from. So, but people didn't want to hear about it because they thought that organic meant dirty or brown or
not pretty. Organic was not pretty.
So it was hard to be to for that in the 60s, 70s,
and especially
it wasn't
as a high-end caterer, because you were always a pretty high-end caterer.
I think food should be beautiful.
And then also people were very slow to disbelieve these great corporations they had grown up with, A and B, who really kept them from famine. People remembered their grandparents being like, oh, the Great Depression, people were starving in this country. And so, that doesn't just get forgotten.
A cheap and abundant supply of food.
The abundant supply got the vote.
It's still a huge problem.
People like Mary early on saw that, greed and low quality was starting to seep into the point that you had to, as you say, stick to your guns.
Right. The capitalism without values was taking over our food supply.
Let me ask you this, because when you talk about buying locally and buying sustainably and all of that stuff, we inevitably talk about a somewhat higher price tag.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you were selling through these menus that were using local farm, let's go back to like the 80s and 90s.
Yeah.
Were people willing to pay that extra premium price, or were you able to conceal that was part of the cost for you, or how did you do it? I was in the catering business for years, and believe me, I bought all commodity products, no problem.
It's just always been the way
I've
done
what
it.
You did.
Just been...
But how could you afford it, Mary, and make money? Because you obviously made money. You did well.
Well, I didn't make money. It's a very low margin business, and my goal is for the people who work with me, everybody can have a sustainable income. And
how many people work with you?
We have about 40 full time, and then there are lots of freelancers, who come and go depending on how many events we have, and if it's a party for 500.
So, like right now, people.
Well, the restaurant is.
Right now, you have a lot of jobbing in, but the rest of the time, probably not. Because don't you have a ton of parties for Christmas?
Yeah, we do. But actually, not a ton. Christmas is still blooming, actually. But the restaurant is now. Has more steady employees.
Yeah.
So
tell me a little bit of the quickly, and just some like bullet points, because we want to get to some catering questions, but who were some of the key players who were still in it, who you grew up with, in the New York food scene, and who were either your mentors or your peers? your cohorts, and you know, that then came along and did their thing with you and have grown with you, and who you've maintained friendships with.
Yeah.
Or who you admire.
Well, there are a lot. We have a great group of chefs now, I think, who are working in the sustainable food movement. Certainly, I think Peter Hoffman was one of the first, and he got very involved in Chefs Collaborative, which sort of took it to a national level. Mm-hmm. Michel Nichon, who's not in New York, but is around New York.
He's a dressing room. And yeah.
He's coming
airlines.
To the show in December.
Yeah, oh, that's great. I really like Michel. Yeah. He's a very sweet man.
He's a lovely guy. Yeah.
Wonderful guy. And
Bill Telepan must be another one.
Bill Telepan. Yeah. Yep. And I'm working with his Wellness in the Schools program this year.
Oh,
so
you
I
are?
Can sort of just get us. Yeah.
We had that. We had that. We did a show on that. Yeah. Yeah, that's a wonderful group.
Yeah.
Nancy Easton. And,
yes.
Yeah.
They're
doing some
and it's
stuff.
Really eye-opening to get into the public school system and see how the school food works, and that they have one, you know, there's only one type of squash that you're allowed to purchase, you know, zucchini, that's it. No winter squash on there.
Well, I have my whole thing about schools. I'm always reluctant to talk about school lunch unless it's like a private school or university, because I think it's asking too much of the sustainable food movement to feed the public school system right now. So I would like to see every corporate cafeteria, ball field, music venue do it first and create that supply and energy before asking where you have
chain.
9 cents a meal. Yeah. I mean, I almost can't even
There's
put
so
my head around
waste,
that.
There's so much waste, Patrick. There's so much waste. In the. I mean, that's what they have buckets where the kids throw away their food at the end of the
they
lunch.
Do. But they're also throwing away like all the fresh produce, and I mean the things that people have struggled to get into the system are being discarded just as quickly as they're coming onto the tray. So it's not just, I mean, that's the problem in a lot of ways is trying to get the kids to try these new things and to get interested in them, and at a grade school level I think that's a big challenge.
They were
really
happy
do.
To eat salad at the salad bar.
Yeah,
you know,
it's
so
it's all about layout. There are ways you can lay out the cafeteria, the way the cafeteria is designed right now at most schools.
Ooh, that's interesting,
encourages
Emma.
Purchasing of lesser
of junk food.
Yeah,
yeah.
Of junk food.
And there's way too much variety. They don't need that much variety, you know. So I think that
yeah, they give them a menu that's like
too much,
you know,
choice.
Yeah. I think it's just like show up with the stuff and make it taste good.
But the certainly the, you know, the edible schoolyard model and you know, teaching kids how to grow food is a really wonderful way to get them to eat vegetables, too.
No, absolutely. And I always love my lunch lady. We dedicated our senior year yearbook to our lunch lady.
Thelma.
Thelma, who is just, she's awesome. And if you're out there, Thelma, I hope you're listening.
Yay.
I love you. So, and then I want to talk real quick about the Chelsea Market. So my girlfriend, Anne, works at one of the first sustainable businesses to move into the Essex Street Market. Yep. Which is a public market that Fiorella LaGuardia started in the 30s.
Yep, I used to shop there when I was living in Little Italy. Yeah.
So tell me, does the Chelsea Market work as a concept, like bringing 40 businesses together in a row and talk about markets and public markets and Chelsea Market in particular?
Yeah, well, the Chelsea Market, I'm Cleaver Company's an original tenant, we have seen tremendous growth there in the 14 years it's been open. I mean, the neighborhood has completely changed, and I think the market had a lot to do with it.
Were you there from day one?
Yeah. Hmm. Well, I was one of the original tenants, so there were several others.
Yeah, you were still just the Cleaver Company when you first moved in there, and then you developed the restaurant
concept.
Right,
well, you had to be a wholesaler in order to be in the Chelsea Market, and you had to retail what you wholesaled because the zoning was for manufacturing, right? And I had made these frozen dinners at our kitchen in Tribeca because the Tribeca business was really a breakfast and lunch business, but I wanted people to, it was really before Tribeca was residential. So we made chicken pot pies and mushroom pot pies and frozen things for that people could take home to heat up. So there was always a dinner you could buy if you wanted to. So that was my ticket into the Chelsea Market. You had to be a manufacturer. Anyway, I learned the day I signed the lease that the one client I was trying to develop as a wholesale client let me know that you had to have a USDA kitchen in order to manufacture anything with more than 2% raw meat or 3% cooked meat. And that was not what I was doing.
Right.
I was building a Department of Health New York City Department of Health kitchen. So anyway, I signed a lease saying I would manufacture vegetable pot pies. But then we sold. We became known as the pot pie people in the Chelsea market because that was our retail face. And then I opened the restaurant because I just wanted to have a lower price point place where people could buy our farm to table food and they could learn about farm to table cuisine. It was really a little bit of a classroom idea, so people could really begin to get connected.
Yeah.
And then the restaurant is just so that was and in grown, the grown, so.
So it's 14 years ago. That was in the mid '90s.
Yeah. I moved into the market in 97 and, I opened the restaurant in 2004 and then we just expanded it.
But even when you were at Cleaver Company there and you didn't have the green table, you were still selling, I think you had salads and things like
that.
Yeah.
We had a takeout counter.
Yeah.
It was a lunch counter.
So, first of all, we should do a shout out to Emilio. It's been too long. We've not said anything about Emilio, who is the nicest man in the world. But talking about Emilio as a transitional thing to catering, I always wanted to know, like, catering, is it a... It just seems everyone is doing it now. I mean, so many people I meet say they have a catering, because it's easy to say. It's like saying I'm a writer, you know? Like, there's nothing...
I don't feel like there are anywhere near as many as there used to be. Do you think, Mary?
I don't know. There's always been a lot of people that say,
I'll come over to your house and prepare something. You know, or anyone who deems themselves as chefs has visions of being a caterer, you know, and teaching their skills to the masses or to other people or educating, or they've invented something or their mother had a recipe. So
a lot of people don't stick with it, though, Patrick, because it's really hard.
It's brutally hard.
What's so hard about it? I mean, tell us, you know, from the customer's perspective. 16-hour
days, 20-hour days, 5 days in a row.
365 days a year.
But, I mean, we have Thanksgiving on
Friday in our house, you know. It's like,
yeah.
Well, there are a lot of businesses like that. So what's so hard? Is the challenge for catering equipment problems at the places you end up having to go to, or keeping food hot? The challenge?
Well, there are many
personalities.
All of the above. There are many, 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 many. It's problem solving, you know. You're and it's performance art. So you're going into a location where you've maybe never been before, and there's no kitchen, and you're cooking dinner for 200 people. So you have to figure out how to do it, and there are a lot of moving parts, and it's a little bit like a relay race. I started out as the chef, and now I really am a planner and run the business, and you know, my creative work is designing the events and working on menus and that sort of thing. But so that information that you design this event, and then there are all many, 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 many hands that go into making that happen. And, you know, ultimately you want to end up with the party you envisioned, or if not, that you've managed to juggle all the problems that come up along the way.
Hmm. There are always problems. I mean, when I was in the catering business, which I was in for so many years, on a much, much less grand scale than yours, Mary, but there is no end to the things that could go wrong. And finally, you know, my motto was, if something can go wrong, it will. So whether it's your, you know, rented propane stove doesn't work, or you forgot the lemons, or, you know, or the dessert isn't working, or the oven doesn't get hot, or the frying pan. Well, you know, I mean, whatever it is, it's just amazing how many things can go wrong, because you're usually offsite, right?
Yep.
And so you don't have, if you haven't planned for every single eventuality, you're screwed.
Right, I mean, have you figured it out? I mean, there's still always issues.
Every job is different, Patrick. Yep. I mean, I can't emphasize that enough, you know? Yeah. I mean, it really is performance art, and you have one show.
And what is your goal? Is to make it beautiful or seamless?
Mary makes beautiful food.
So you invest in flowers? And I mean,
we do full design work, if that's... and we all, you know, it's a very collaborative business, which is part of what's so fun about it. You know, you have a lot of people working on something together to make it happen.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, we were talking earlier, like, what's your favorite kind of client?
Yeah, I was going to ask, like, it must be bat mitzvahs. No, just kidding. I don't know.
Weddings.
Sometimes. Sometimes.
And then do you have annual events for, like, to Citibank?
Yeah, you have lots of corporate clients.
Actually,
right?
My annual events are much more typically not-for-profit fundraising galas.
And you get paid for those? I mean, as well as you deserve to? Or because it's a nonprofit, you're like, how could I take this away from the Black Farmers Association of America or something?
Yeah, no, there's a lot of partnering, and we give a lot you know, we give a lot. People ask all the, you know, we get calls every day for
Slow
donations.
Food, Alice Waters, yeah. Edible.
Oh, yeah, I see your name popping up all over the place. On
And we do what we can because we really believe in improving the food supply.
And so your employees are on board with the same philosophical content that you...
They have to be.
They have to be.
Yeah, or you don't hire them. Or Mary brings down the hammer, the cleaver.
Oh, that's right.
That's how it started.
It has to. I mean, come on, we got to make a play on that name, Mary. Come on. All of her. And her employees cleave to her.
When someone gets fired from Cleveland Company, they're like, they got cleaved. They
I haven't heard any of that, but it might be,
Are you
so
kidding?
What should a customer look for? Like, I think about, for instance,
what makes a good
Paradise Soccer Meets in Kansas City. The kid's getting married, you know, the guy who runs the slaughterhouse floor. And I'm like, well, and I don't know what to say. And so if they're going to surround themselves with people, like, what are the key things on a website, or what does a caterer need to say, or what are the skill sets you think is most important for a successful caterer, other than just simply problem solving? Because people Google catering, they must find 100.
Right. Well, you have to know that your caterer is supplying you with really high quality ingredient food. I think, you know, really. So start with the ingredients, right? And then, you know, really catering is 50% production, 50% food. So you want to make sure that the planning is very thorough, and that they're really, you have that you're working with an experienced caterer.
And they should be communicative to you and have all the answers to your questions and all that.
Yeah, or know how to find the answer if they don't. I mean, really the most important thing is to have a good relationship with your very trusting. You have to find a caterer that you can trust. It's a, because
sort of like getting a surgeon or something.
Because then they can really just do the best job for you.
Because I would be so nervous to have never worked with a caterer before, and it's the biggest event of your life.
Well, if it's a wedding or something like that, which is often people's first experience with a caterer.
Yes, it is. It's a lot of money right off the bat.
Yeah, and you really want to know that the expectations that you have are the same expectations that your caterer has.
Yeah.
That you share that vision.
Yes.
That ultimate vision.
Most of our work really is word of mouth. I mean, people have been to an event and they've liked the food, or they, you know, they've enjoyed working with the staff. They like the way it looks, the whole thing.
Yeah. So what's the worst catering job you ever did? Like, what was just like the craziest story, like, that you tell your favorite employees? Like,
listen, it could be like, should see Mary's face right now.
Oh, that's right.
See, so which one?
Henry VIII. We had that was the worst. You're absolutely right.
That's
the worst.
Absolutely the worst she's ever come home and.
What happened?
It was.
You guys aren't that old. You're not talking about the Henry VIII.
No. Yes. It was a client who came from a bride, you know, and they wanted to have a Halloween party. The assistant who was planning it was a friend of this bride. So it came from a reputable source. He wanted to have a Halloween party that was a Henry VIII theme. And this was planned about 2 weeks before. It was a really sort of last-minute thing. And this man turned out to be absolutely insane. Mm. And but it was a big production with, you know, we laid this amazing
How many
table.
Guests?
And I think it was about 75 guests.
So not huge.
In his home, amazing home on Lower Broadway, you know, just gorgeous with a swimming pool on the roof and a Moroccan themed, you know, terrace and what have you. Oof. It was quite amazing. Several floors. When my staff arrived, he was in a towel with a video camera, and he put the video camera right in their face and wanted to video them while they were setting up. And then, anyway, there were a lot of drugs involved and a lot of horrible behavior.
Now, come on, Mary. You were used to that from the 80s.
People in the swing.
Mary's just
we planned
just
this amazing food.
Yeah, I know. You didn't do any
all
drugs
all this amazing,
this
amazing food, but of course nobody wanted to eat it.
Because they were all getting high.
Yeah, getting high instead. And then there was, you know, lots of bad behavior in the swimming pool all night long. It was just
bad behavior.
And then they never paid the bill.
Okay, getting stiffed.
And I, yeah.
That is the worst.
On top
dead beats
all.
Are talk, the worst.
I know. No. I had that experience a couple times.
Let's not talk
Let's
about
talk it. About what you do. I mean, it's really difficult when you get stiffed on a bill.
Well,
right?
What you do is you collect the money before the event because you have no leverage afterwards. Right. But because there was the... I mean, I was just strung along and just... I'm
As were they.
Yeah. And I tell you, I have never wanted to do physical violence to anybody ever in my life until this
I like
came
it.
Up with this man.
That is so right. Because listen, with deadbeats, you have no leverage. That's all that's left to you. Yeah. You clock yeah. him. You get Emilio.
Yeah.
You bust into their house and you scare the shit out
yeah.
of them.
And they have no shame. I mean, I remember I was like dirt poor and I got stiffed on a party and it was a bill. This was like in the 80s and... You know, I mean, I lived on a real shoestring.
Yeah.
And I think the bill was like $400
yeah,
or something.
Yeah, and they wouldn't pay you.
And they wouldn't pay. And I was out of pocket for all the yeah. stuff. And it was just like, it was like, that was my rent money.
Yeah.
Okay. And no, my, I mean, it was just unbelievable.
It's
I,
the worst thing.
It's,
you,
it was so
stealing.
Gross.
It's
it is stealing.
It's stealing.
You can then yeah. argue.
And then
it's
I
only
even
books.
Had a friend
they
who was a lawyer who wrote the guy a threatening letter for me for, you know. And I still didn't respond.
Right.
And I was like, well, then what do you do after that?
No, those then you have to pay a lawyer or you have
to
pay.
Yeah, exactly.
Like,
oh,
yeah.
It's so deeply, deeply, deeply
But it was
wrong.
Just like so mean.
It taps
to
into
screw
people's
this.
Financial security and their yeah. and the common bonds of business and human beings.
Right.
And if those people are there, they should be called out.
Yeah.
They have
yeah.
to be. Because God forbid some other, you know, poor fool, you know, and some farm believes in them.
That's
and
right.
then they do the same thing. You're like, why didn't I? It's a responsibility to
yeah,
to
I should have,
notify.
Like, I'd done something. I don't know.
We've often thought there should be a list of
I'm
all,
happy
the,
you said
all
yeah.
the clients to avoid in
yes.
New York City.
And you're just like,
there
three
should
people
be.
Said it.
Yeah, don't do business with this right. person.
And you have to be able to provide an invoice. You know, and say this is the unpaid invoice, you know, so that way you're not just but we did rent a website, whosgoingtohell.com, and maybe we could have a
we could have a subcategory
yeah.
for deadbeats.
A subcategory for deadbeats, and if you're
yeah.
a farmer
yeah.
and you can
put
prove
them up
an
there.
Invoice and you
yeah.
can confirm a thing, then they are part of that website. So we should really get that active, Jack.
Yeah.
Another thing to put on your to-do list.
I have some ideas for the first few.
Yeah.
Oh, Jack, turn it off. No, stop. Well, this has been so awesome. I mean, I'm such a fan, and I love that you buy from groups like us and all the stuff you do, and I love that your staying power, because I think the only way to really
That's
make change.
That's the thing that really is. I mean, we still have a few minutes left, so let's just quickly.
Yeah, we have like 7 minutes left. But I just want to say that.
Let's
staying
explore
power
that for a second. Yeah.
Is the greatest
because Mary,
gift.
You know, your services have never come cheap. You've always valued what you did and done, you know, I thought very fair.
We're paying $800
for yeah, just
Mary
for her
right
coming
now.
In.
I don't think that we're not expensive in the marketplace.
You're not.
I mean,
and you get
a
the
wide
best
range of,
ingredients,
yeah.
which and you so. Always have, which I thought was, you know, which is one of the reasons why I thought it was fun to have you on.
To?
Yeah.
Commodity. I mean, the slow food movement, the sustainable. It's not more expensive.
Well, it's hard
we
to make money on a catering
yeah.
gig. Period. And so, if you're buying really good ingredients, your food margins, your food costs go up, but you can't really charge a lot more than
I think there's
the market
also,
rate.
There's a lot of talk now about the do-it-yourself movement. I mean, we've always done it ourselves. I mean, I think maybe it's coming back. I don't know. Did it go away for a while? I don't know.
It totally went away.
Well, so, what I think it is, it's now you
it was
are,
all
you
about
I've done my
power.
Own urban foraging. I mean, I'm...
You were
you know,
one of a group of 50 people. Of 30 people, 50 people, but not like 200,000 people. Like
yeah.
probably in the whole country, I would bet, like Mary in 1980, 500 people.
I would think
maybe
that,
3 or 4 per
maybe
city
even less.
In the most cities,
yeah.
and then maybe 7 in LA, 20 in San Francisco, and the rest on the East Coast. But you know, it is a very small thing. And now I think it's really coming everywhere
so
in every
exciting.
Neighborhood. And so,
so
that's why
great.
I think
Mary,
the
do you
is,
travel and do panels and.
Sometimes, yeah.
You know, I've seen your name pop up on yeah. various sort of panel type things. Mm-hmm. Jean Hodesh has that wonderful Local Gourmands newsletter that, you know, gives the shout out to all the cool food things that are happening. Do
yeah.
you get that?
I don't.
I'm going to forward that
yeah.
to you. Her, the girl
I know
who puts
Jean.
It together is Jean Hodesh.
Yeah.
And she, I mean, it's great.
Yeah.
She puts it out like every week or two, usually every week. And it's just all the cool food events that are happening in
yeah.
the city. She lists
Most of them.
Yeah, good.
And so I've seen you on there, and I've seen you on some of the slow food things, and mm-hmm. yeah.
You do work with Alice too, right? I mean, you did her edible thing, I know. How did that go?
Oh, it was lovely.
She came here and did a little piece a few hours after that Sunday
event. Oh, good, good, good. Yeah. Yeah, no, we've done a number of events with Alice when she's in New York, and her team comes and works out of our kitchen a lot.
Well, that's the one thing about do-it-yourself. No one is really doing it themselves. In fact, it's a hodgepodge taping together of all these individual talents. So, you know, it's really teamwork, you know?
It's
so
do-it-yourself doesn't teamwork. Really but, yeah, I
speak to that but as a term.
But, I mean, it's just if something needs to be figured out, we try to figure it out, you know?
True. And it's anti-corporation, you know, I mean, yeah, what we're just talking with Mary, you know, is finding a way to unite all these local energies into a common cause. And of course, I think a common enemy needs to be found, and not all corporations, because like the Hearst Corporation is a huge supporter of ours, of the station, and they do great stuff. Yeah. But I mean, the corporation, the lack of traceability, not knowing who to call, or hierarchy of
power.
The lack
of transparency in corporate food is very troubling.
It's very troubling.
That I think that should really be addressed at a policy level, as part of the Department of Agriculture or something. But
and who the enemies are, like Mary said, for the deadbeats.
I never want to talk about enemies, especially in the food world, because I think that
Purdue and Smithfield. I'm sorry.
Yeah, there should be standards of animal welfare that are.
They should get graded.
They should, but they should be graded, and those, just as we do with restaurants, those grades should be made public.
A, B, and C,
and that is an option for forcing them to raise the bar, but. In terms of vilifying the people who...
Environmental...
Yeah, right. Water waste.
Yeah.
Until they come to the table. Purdue is making too many profits on the back of
There's no incentive to bring them to the table until you, A, change policy, and B, get enough people to vote with their dollars.
Where is my policy representative right now? I don't know, but I can launch Heritage Foods or launch a network, and I can vote with my dollar I believe in, but trying to march on Albany...
Change the commodity system. We cannot be having our taxpayer dollars sending our topsoil to the Gulf of Mexico with poison. You know, it's just idiotic.
Or the farm bill that's coming up for vote next.
What power do we have over that? Nothing.
Call your congressman.
You have to vote.
Don't vote in people who are in the pockets of the corn lobby. Yeah. Right, Emma? Emma's ready to say something.
We spend so much of our... I mean, everybody says, you know, local, sustainably grown food is more expensive. It wouldn't be more expensive if we weren't spending massive amounts of federal funds that come from our tax dollars to subsidize
commodity
bad
food.
Agriculture. I mean...
I just don't know how to fix that. That's my only thing. If I felt power
vote.
In that system...
You vote and you raise your voice.
You are fixing it by helping to build another kind of food supply, and that's a help.
And bringing them to the table.
We also have to vote, and we also have to
care about
that. Oh,
yeah, it all has
that.
To happen. But Emory, Virginia Tech, this radio station, letters... public emails.
Yeah.
Until
these are all great forces.
People have to learn that the food supply is not healthy.
It's education, and
animals are being abused. That's my biggest.
And people are being abused in those slaughterhouses. I mean, it's not just the animals.
Not all of them, and not all of the animals. I mean, it's
she just got a free paid trip to visit.
I know,
the
and
sport,
I you know
so
now I'm like the biggest fan.
Corporation.
I'm not pro corporations, but I've always said that there is room at the table for a lot of these producers, especially if they subscribe to a better practice. And most of these guys, and come on, this is a money game. Yeah. We're not talking about people who want to abuse animals for the sake of abusing animals. And in fact, an animal that is not treated well, does not grow well, does not bring back a return on the dollar.
That is where you're wrong. You know,
no, I'm
people
not wrong.
That was also in the slavery movement. People would be like, well, a beaten slave that won't work as hard. So, you know, but you don't know that and the fact that it's a possibility that it could be happen. A public grade system done by an independent holds everyone accountable.
I think that's a great idea. You also have to remember that there's no reason why food should be cheap.
Exactly. Well, that is a really hard sell, Mary.
Yeah, but I mean, it's...
That's the hardest sell of all.
It happened, you know, I mean...
This
the Nixon administration and Earl Butz. I mean,
$6, make it cheap.
Right.
This country spends 6% of their average gross
income.
Right.
Each person spends about 6% on food.
And other cultures,
Europe, it's 25% and above.
Right, exactly.
And that tells you something. And guess who has better food?
Yeah.
Hello?
Yeah. They have a lot of regulation, and they, you know, the politicians in Europe actually have an interest in getting better food out into the markets.
Absolutely.
Which we don't
their
here.
Constituents, you know, will not accept less
absolutely
than good food.
And it's not all everything about that's genetically money. Modified is marked as such. We don't do
it's
that
all about
here.
Money, yeah. Well, I mean, everyone is like, oh, what's the story with the $150 turkey? I'm like, at $8 a pound, that's Applebee's and Houlihan's costs $8 a person or more. I mean, it costs more than $8
a person. I mean, people are surprised when they hear that a Happy
too.
Meal
as long
is
as they're
$8.
Accused of being elitist, also, I'm fine with being called elitist. But if we are and they're not, that's ridiculous. And by the way, most Americans, most, can afford a meal at Houlihan's. So for four people. And I think there's that 5% is very sad.
I
don't know that 70% of the population can't go. They go to McDonald's and eat a value meal. Turkey, same price.
Yeah. And
including FedEx, $140, $8 a person, $8 a person.
And
it's right there.
If you eat a heritage breed turkey, you're not going to be at the same time both malnourished and obese, which you will be if
That's
you
right.
get all of your nutrition in quotes, from McDonald's or wherever.
Yeah, and it's literally, I think, the same price. Katie disagrees. She's like, yes, but you can go and sign up for a bank account and get a free turkey, and that's free, and that's true, too. But
you're very unfair to me.
No, but you say...
Just that I am not about to throw the baby out with the bathwater. I think that there are efficiencies to commodity agriculture, which should be looked at with some interest. I mean, these
like
guys...
Like what? The cow goes through 50 different people before it finally gets to slaughter.
No, they go through about 4 different people. Ask Brian Kennedy. Kenny.
Right, all right.
It's not... I mean, I'm not saying that that's ideal, but I am saying that if you... First of all, you have to think about this in a global sense, because we export about $33 million worth of food. It's like, it has a huge impact on our national economy. And protein
33
is
million?
A very big.
Doesn't
oh, it's more than
much.
That. It's more than that. Sorry, no, but 33%. Excuse me, but it's a giant portion of our national economy is our agricultural product, and these guys are raising more with less input, and that has to be acknowledged. And once we can do something
but
similar
what cost,
to that,
at what cost to the soil? What cost to our future? I mean, topsoil is renewable in an ice age, but you know,
it's renewable if people compost.
But I mean, the way that
no, the way it's being used now is wrong.
And, yeah.
Listen, I'm not saying that these are good things, that monocultures are a good thing, or that confined area feeding operations are ideal. But what I am saying is that there's something to learn from this, that there is something to extract from this in terms of building a better food system.
Yeah.
And to vilify these people and deny them a part of the conversation, or to, you know, create an us against them environment.
Katie, they don't want to be part of the conversation.
But
they don't
will.
Say anything. They won't ever speak out because they don't want their practices to be known.
Well, that's why we're going to get on
NPR. But that's part of the media. Yeah. That's the part of the responsibility of the media.
Until we're like 100 years old.
Yeah. I mean,
until they're forced to.
As somebody who's in food journalism, it's the responsibility of the media to create an environment in which those practices are exposed, that people are getting information
about
this stuff.
But these are
and I'm all for that.
Yeah.
And eventually they're going to have to cave. I mean, you know, all of these terrible
but only if
food
the,
system
if,
problems we've had.
Right, but each person has a right to vote with your dollar every day, right?
And to
with
vote
their, with his dollar
for
every day.
The representative
to
that
vote,
represents
vote.
Your food
exactly.
interests.
I vote to have all my meals catered.
Yeah, because Patrick doesn't like to cook. He thinks that we should have like momofuku
like Mary,
sambar.
It's 7:15.
Creating pork buns
to
for the masses. I don't know how David Chang would feel about that, but we'll have to get him on the show.
Some big chef has to open a fast food franchise. Period. I mean, I will beyond support that, but it's just a matter of time, and
doesn't
it's the
have
only
to be a big
legacy
chef. Chipotle
that'll matter.
Does a great
job.
I mean,
Chipotle does their sourcing is really
it's
pretty
excellent.
Good. I mean, in the realm of fast food,
exactly,
they're making an effort at least.
It's like a
communist they make an
ceiling.
Effort,
if
and
you
they
make
succeed.
X amount of dollars as a chef, you have to then do something for the people by opening some public, you know, pizza joint or whatever that does compete with McDonald's. I mean, I think that They almost owe it to Missouri and Kansas and Nebraska and Wyoming that they are these little in and out spots, but nationally, not just on the West Coast.
And I want to do it with my my frozen dinners. Just produce produce them regionally using regional product and distributing them.
That's a great idea.
And do that all around the country.
Portland
and
would be a great base city for that region. They would seem really into
Portland,
stuff like that.
Des Moines, I mean, you know, they know how to make food in Des Moines. They know how to
They have the infrastructure.
It, right? Yeah, they have the infrastructure.
So. And that's what you really
but
have
we don't
to look
have
for.
A USDA processing plant available in the Northeast right now.
Well, listen, put me in charge of finding one or, you know, pay someone on my staff to go. I guarantee we would bring the consultants and find the people through an interview process to run that plant soon. And, you know, the one thing the state could do is make the whole killing process a little easier to navigate and to reward people that unite the kill floor and the processing floor.
Well, we're working on that with, you know, I'm on the board of an organization out of Glenwood called LILA, Local Infrastructure for Local Agriculture.
Oh, cool.
And we've started, the first project is a modular harvesting system, which is essentially a mobile
slaughtering
unit.
That's a mobile slaughtering unit. Well, Patrick has strong feelings about those.
Well, I think it's a great thing. I mean, I don't think, again, it's going to rock the world of every farmer.
No. But it's just a way for smaller producers to have their animals processed.
Yeah, but when they process their animals in a mobile slaughtering unit, where is the...
They have to buy it back, or someone has to buy the animal whole.
Well, there needs to be, you know, it needs to be adjacent to a processing plant.
Exactly. So and then 50 farmers work together with that mobile slaughterhouse, and then you have 25 pigs a week.
And how many animals can you process in a mobile slaughterhouse?
10 a day.
Yeah.
That's good. That's all. I mean, it's not a lot, but 10 of those.
But you had 10 of them, you have 1,000 animals a day. Yeah.
Well, the idea behind it is just that it's less expensive than building from scratch a plant. It's a start.
It also circumvents the not in my backyard syndrome that
you just drive it away.
The idea is to have several docking stations around the Hudson Valley so that
I'd like to offer my place on Clinton Street in Brooklyn as a docking station. Doot, doot, doot. Chunk backs in and locks in, gets power.
You could probably make that work in Brooklyn because everybody's so plugged
in. Chris.
Let's add another trailer. It's four trailers.
Well, Chris Parkin, I will give him credit. I mean, if someone comes to him with an idea and is like, and I have the funding and ability to figure it out and I'm going to manage it, he will make it a part of his network if it's good and interesting. So, well, this has been great. Thank you so much for staying and honoring us with your presence.
Absolutely,
well,
Mary.
It's been great to be here.
There's over 200 years of combined food experience that I'm looking
at least.
Right here.
Come on,
Mary.
I go back way. That's our running joke, Mary, is that I'm sort of like the Paleolithic representative here.
What was it like before boats, Katie? Before trade?
We need to use boats again to bring product down the Hudson River.
Actually. Oh, the Erie Canal.
I know, right?
Yeah.
That's what it was
That's
built
probably
for.
One of the three biggest things that's ever happened to the New York City is the Erie Canal.
The Erie Canal changed the food landscape around the country, actually. It was like one of the single most important developments in food and agriculture.
Yeah.
I would put the grid system, the grid, DeWitt Clinton's making the grid on the top three. And then the third, I'm not quite sure yet, but those would be two big ones.
Flour milling.
And we'd love, Mary, for you to be an advisor and a supporter of our food museum idea, which Dave Arnold conceived it. But we want to do a massive food museum
that Mary
eventually
would be perfect
grows
for that.
To the size, you know, of like a natural history museum.
Like
but
a
all
Smithsonian.
Food, all interactive.
Excellent.
So we want to raise a lot of money for that. And
like to work for not-for-profit.
No, just kidding.
Yeah, we're just kidding, Mary, really.
No, so we're going to take a break, and we're going to come back with...
We'll come back with Liz Grossberger from Chicago, who's going to give us a report from the front. And
Chi-Town.
Yeah, Chi-Town, my favorite. Meatpacking Central. Said, honey, I'm leaving for good.
Dog.
It's the main course.
She is awesome, Mary.
Mary Cleaver.
She's a real doer. She has a quiet way about her, but yes. She's a real force in nature.
But she said, I was not a shill for the commodity food market, Patrick.
Mm-hmm. And I disagreed.
I'm not a shill.
You make me sick.
Want to. Patrick!
No, just kidding.
I just want to bring everyone to the table.
No, as but Temple you do that Grandin, by being like, what's your grade? Where are all your farms like that? Are any animals being abused in any component or facet of your company? Why can't you change that? What would the effect on your bottom line be if you had a certain base standard for every farm?
Well, I think every farm should be held to
they
a certain...
They didn't let you onto their slaughterhouse
But now
floor.
They're going to.
Well, because Temple did it. You're going to have to walk on all fours with
That's
Temple.
Right. Temple Grandin is going to take me on a guided tour of a JBS plant in Colorado in the next few weeks.
But Chicago used to be the big one.
Yeah. And so to talk about Chicago and Chicago restaurants as part of our ongoing new series on checking in with cities around the country on the food scene, we have Liz Grossberger. Hi, Liz. Are you there?
Hi, I am. How are you guys?
And Liz, you're the managing editor of Plate Magazine, right?
Yes.
And tell us.
Yes.
And you have a wonderful blog called, tell me.
It's called Elizabeth.
Elizabeth. Oh, I thought it was called Ditka.
You know, I thought about that name. I did. Yeah. But,
And you should have. That's right. Absolutely. But luckily, you went for Elizabeth's.
Yes.
So, Liz, you and I met on a certified... No, we went on a pork crawl.
Yes, we did.
That was fabulous.
That was fantastic. I loved the getting on a trolley and basically going, you know, from restaurant to restaurant trying amazing pork dishes. So that was a lot of fun.
Where
great
was
representation
in
of a lot
Colorado?
Of chefs.
And, no, it was in Chicago.
Oh, in Chicago. Liz, what's, yeah. What restaurants?
Belly Shack,
yep.
The Publican.
We went to Big Star,
right?
Which
that
is,
was great.
Pork belly tacos. We went to Motto,
and there was one more. One more. I don't think I ate to the same degree that I did on the Philadelphia pork crawl, which I was sorry you missed because it would have been fun
yes,
to have had you with me.
I did want to go to that. I heard it was great. Well, it's just such a fun concept because you're literally on a trolley, you know, just trying different dishes and. You know, hanging with the chefs and talking to them. It was a lot of fun. It's a great concept they have.
Well, what I thought was really cool about it was, given that the American Pork Board sponsored this tour, I was surprised that they that we tried pork that was both commodity pork and also pork that was specialty, you know, heritage breed pork from different smaller farms. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was very cool that they were supporting both of those concepts, which goes back to the argument we were just having about... commodity versus, you know, sustainably raised animals and produce. And, you know, my friends here now think I'm a total shill for the corporate geeks. But the fact is, I just think that they...
Katie has a confined calf in the back of the station.
That's right. It's in a box.
Right.
But let's talk about, like, what, you know, we were talking earlier. Who was it you said? Who did you quote?
Well, William Rice said that, you know, he used to work, maybe he still consults with the Chicago Tribune.
Yeah.
And he said that, you know, when people think about going out, they're thinking about a steak in Chicago, or at least that's the way it had been, you know, for most of his lifetime. And therefore, you know, it was hard for other businesses or some restaurant trying to break new ground with a new cuisine
Concepts,
or an ethnic
cuisine
to break into the market and to remain very successful. Like, obviously, there's a lot of ethnic cuisines there, and I think you have a big Polish neighborhood there, and there's other stuff going on. But, like, for the most part, the dominance of meat has made Chicago be a bit slower to evolve. I mean, is that the case or is that not true in your opinion?
You know, I what's interesting is I think that the steakhouses are still, I mean, you know, I think we just had like two new ones open, like Benny's Chop House and this place called Chicago Cut. So it's sort of like they're going strong. I think there's always going to be, you know, diners that do want to go to the steakhouses and the Gibsons and the Mortons and things like that. But, you know, there's definitely an evolution with, you know, other kinds of restaurants and people, you know, we actually just got our Michelin guide last week.
Huh,
really? The first Michelin guide for Chicago. So
who
got stars? Sorry?
Who got stars?
Oh, well, all kinds of people. You know, it's there were the two, Alinea got 3 stars, which was, you know, so there's these very high-end kind of, you know, the molecular gastronomy being recognized, you know, internationally, I think. So, you know, there's definitely chefs that are doing, you know, there still seem to be meat heavy, whether it's, you know, obviously a lot of pork. Stephanie Izzard's Girl and the Goat is like crazy busy all the time and just, you know, pretty hard to get into. And she's kind of focusing on goats. So, you know, I'd say there's definitely focus, you know, it doesn't have to be a classic steakhouse, but, you know, those are crowded and those are doing really well. But chefs are doing so many other things, too, that are being recognized.
Cool. So
yeah.
So Stephanie is doing goats. So you think she took a page out of Bill Nyman's book? Is that her source?
You know, yeah, Bill Nyman like, invented the goat. About
yeah, she's doing all kinds of things. But her, you know, her restaurant's called Girl and the Goat, and she has like a smoked goat pizza. But she has, you know, really interesting items, and she does like a lot of pork dishes. I think she has a pig face, which I think Katie and I got to try that at the Bristol, which was that other restaurant
when they brought in pig head. Yeah. Yeah, we ate pig head in a few places, I thought. Or maybe not. Maybe we ate pig's head definitely in Philadelphia. And we had suckling pig in two or three places, which I thought was really kind of interesting. And that was a big, big new trend in Philly. How about Chicago? Are you guys seeing a lot of suckling pig there?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's definitely, you know, pretty huge. I know, like, at the Publican, I need to see if they have that, you know, on the menu right now. But I know that, like, pig in general, like Motto, which is one of the stops that we went to, I think he did pig heart.
Yes, that was awful, I thought.
Well, he had, like, a change-up at the last minute. I think he maybe wasn't planning on doing that.
I don't know, but it was like, I'll never eat that again. That was gross.
Yeah. It was
did you like it?
You know, it was okay. I kind of liked the application. He sort of did like that Asian application, which maybe saved it a little bit. But
it was kind of a slippery, hard piece of meat.
It was just kind of a little strange.
Too muscular.
He's actually since left the restaurant, Rob, but what they went to work on, I think, his own butcher shop. But he was doing kind of whole pig demonstrations for people for a while. So,
well, that's interesting. You're saying he's opening a butcher shop. We were talking about that earlier on the show. We had Mary Cleaver on, who runs a restaurant and a catering business here and has always been very much in the forefront. And we were talking about the growth of new butchers and butcher shops in New York. Is that also the case in Chicago? Are you seeing a real revival of that?
You know, I haven't heard too much about that, and I'm pretty sure that is what he's doing. I think that's what I heard. It was kind of a recent news story, but I haven't seen, you know, too much of that. That's kind of the first I've heard of that, but I know that was sort of a passion of theirs.
Interesting.
They were inviting people in to see, you know, demos and things like that.
Huh. Because we have that's all over the map here. I mean, we have the Meat Hook with Tom Mylan here in Brooklyn, and he has classes all the time to show people how to take a pig apart, how to take a rabbit apart or whatever. Jake Dixon, I think, has done a few DIYs. I know Jimmy's number 43, a bar on the Lower East Side, had a whole pig deconstruction class. I mean, it's really taken off here.
Well, Paul Kahan was one of the biggest pig proponents, right?
And he was our host. He curated our restaurant.
He did, yes.
Avec and his other restaurant is
he has the Publican, and Red Star,
and Blackbird.
Oh, Blackbird, right.
That was his flagship.
Oh, that is his. Publican is his. Wow. Yeah. And then you also have the White House chef came out of Chicago, right? The guy who cooks for the Obamas every day.
You mean Sam Cass?
Sam Cass. He was a friend of Paul Kahn's and from Chicago.
Right.
That's kind of cool. I mean, Chicago maybe it is the opposite. It maybe it's not a commodity run city, but
Liz, as you travel around reviewing restaurants, which you do for your blog, and also writing about them for Plate, what do you see in terms of the change in trends for how people, you know, supply their restaurants, and what are their big concerns there?
Well, you know, I'm seeing a lot of local, you know, kind of trying to get things from local farms and things. I don't know if it's just the restaurants I've been going to. I was just in New Orleans, and I went to Cochon, which was delicious. We had all kinds of pork products. But, you know, I think that I need to, you know, see kind of where they're getting everything. It seems like there's also this stress, you know, on local farms and kind of getting things more locally, but from commodity boards as well, you know. So, you know, I'm definitely seeing a lot of that. And I know, like, here in Chicago, like, the local thing is still pretty huge. Like, talking about Stephanie, like, with the goat, I know that she's going to, like, local farms in Illinois and around the surrounding areas to get sort of the goat that she's picking that isn't, like, going to be too gamey and is going to, you know, that she's sort of, like, tried and, you know, is a fan of.
But, you know, by contrast, like one of the places we went was Belly Shack, which I can't remember the name of the chef, but I liked him so much.
It's Bill Kim. Mm-hmm.
Right. And the food was absolutely wonderful. That might have been my favorite restaurant, actually. And in terms of just the sheer sort of interest and marriage of multi-culti food preparations, I thought it was so good. But he happily and cheerfully admitted to buying commodity pork just because his bottom line simply did not allow for
I can't buy it.
Specialty raised.
Look at where we ate Cabrito yesterday.
Yeah.
We ate Cabrito. They have $8-$9 stuff. That is BS beyond belief. A pork belly for $2 from a sustainable guy works in any food combination, especially if it's just one thing. So to say you support commodity, I don't know. I can't just stand by and hear that. I mean, it's absolutely not true that there are certain preparations that can work food cost for you. But anyway, I'm sorry to get all like,
self-righteous. I mean, that's the point of this conversation is to bring up the fact that some people are still thinking, or
that
many
they can't
people
sell
believe
something for $12 and make it work. I mean,
I don't know. I don't know. I'm not a restaurant owner, so I really don't know. What's your insight on that, Liz?
Well, I think what's interesting with Bill is, what he's doing is he's doing something that's, I think, really doing really well as far as what a lot of the chefs are doing is, like, he doesn't, snack trucks are this also, like, street trucks are this sort of bigger thing that's kind of, I know we didn't really see much of that on the tour, but a lot of chefs are kind of pushing to bring the restaurants onto the streets and carts and things, and there's problems with that. But the other thing, is to do what Bill's doing is sort of a lower, it is actually like a lower price point for kind of what he's getting, and doing more of a casual environment, communal dining, but like amazing flavors. And he did like a really interesting combination, I know, with that dish that we had that he was using pork, but it was kind of like a Puerto Rican inspired rice dish, I believe.
Yeah, it was like a coconut rice, which was sensational. And then the pork was was sliced super, super thin, and it had been brined for like 36 hours. It was very juicy and moist, but it was pork loin. It was from the middle meat. It wasn't like shoulder or belly or anything super trendy like that. And then it had some sort of sauteed greens with it, which were also excellent. I mean, it was a wonderful dish. I was totally impressed with it. And but I was surprised that he had used commodity loin, which he was clearly getting at a very decent, very cheap rate, because it was not an expensive dish on his menu for sure.
No, it wasn't. A lot of the dishes, he'll do like sort of Korean and Puerto Rican flavors.
Yeah.
So I know he'll do like a sort of kimchi Korean barbecue, taco or burrito kind of thing. And it's like delicious. And it's maybe $6 or $7. I don't know. I need to check. But that kind of, that price point with all those flavors, in a casual sort of environment, just seems to be doing really well as far as the types of restaurants. We've got Rick Bayless doing Shoko, which is sort of his casual take. It's not, there are tables, but it's, you go to a counter and you order, like it's sort of Mexican tortas and really spicy soups, the caldos, and it's like packed.
Yeah.
So.
So it's sort of like, I feel like these restaurants, in a way we have some of that growing up here with like the meatball store, which is you can get lunch or dinner for a very reasonable price, or some of the, even Cabrito, which was quite reasonable in price. The food was very good quality. It seems to me like since the recession hit that's been, that sort of casual dining formula with very low cost entrees has been what has succeeded the best. And, it doesn't give you a lot of margin for using better quality ingredients, I think, is the issue.
Mm-hmm. But, there is still a focus. I know that, at Shoko, it's like Gunthorpe Farms chicken that he's got in the, like, sort of chicken sandwich. And I think if the flavors are there and some of the ingredients are sourced locally, it sort of becomes, not like a higher-end item, but maybe it's not as casual, it kind of steps it up a little bit. Graham Elliott is opening Grahamwich, which is going to be like sandwiches. I haven't seen a menu yet for that, but kind of these big chefs that are doing, kind of a lower price point place, but with great flavors. And
so is Grant a Shots? Is that, am I saying that right? A Shots?
Oh, no, I was saying Graham Elliott.
I know, but is Alinea's chef, how do you say his name? A Shots?
Oh,
a Shots?
Ackett.
Ackett. Thank you. I've only seen it written. I've never had anybody say it. Is he Is he going to be opening up his own version of, like, the, you know, the frothy sandwich or the...
No, you know, he's working on two projects that are opening sometime soon, maybe a little while, that I think will still be kind of more high-end, but really interesting. He's doing a restaurant and a bar. They're called Aviary and Next, and I believe... Next will be the restaurant. I need to look that up. But it's this very cool concept. It's not like a casual dining. It's actually going to be where you're going to order, and your menu will be from a different city from a different year. So you may be getting Shanghai 2036 or, you know, Paris 1942.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, and you will have to buy a ticket. And, you know, I don't think any menu, you know, you sort of, I'm not sure if you'll know what you're getting, but I know that it's going to be pretty amazing.
That's pretty cool. I like that idea.
Do you?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a true Iron Chef that requires a historical knowledge of cuisine.
Well, that's true. That's for sure. Yeah. What if you get, like, 1963, you know, Wakefield, Rhode Island? I mean,
what if you get, like,
Jell-O mold? I mean,
right.
You know, that could really backfire on you as a diner.
What if you get Ice Age, like, yeah. 30,000 BC.
Yeah, they just give you a, you know, a raw piece of meat on a bone.
Right.
Tell you to dig in.
You're like,
here's
I want
your apron.
I want Tanzania. 30,000 BC.
Yeah, I know. It could lots of possibilities. Yeah. It's pretty cool though, because one of the courses when I was there was sort of I think it went back to, like, you know, he changed out the silverware and it was like a from, like, the late 1800s kind of Paris or something like that. And it was just, it was so cool. And it was just, like, a basic, like, I can't remember what it was. But I know that, like, we had our silverware changed out. So even, like, the goblet was, like, a crystal goblet.
Oh, cool.
And, you know, so I wonder if he's going to change out sort of the whole silverware and the, you know, everything will sort of become like you are back in that era or in the future.
I love the idea. Patrick's right. It's very smart, very forward thinking, and yep. Certainly a whole new
thinking.
Whole new concept in fine dining. I mean, ain't nobody doing that.
Right, right. And then his bar, I think, will just be sort of molecular cocktails, and you know, who knows what he'll kind of come up with. But they're going to be right next to each other in, like, the Fulton Market District, actually right down the street from Publican. So that's turning into a nice little cool restaurant.
And if the food comes out horrible, you're like, well, that was our taste back then.
Mm-hmm.
Just the way things yeah. were. I'm just staying loyal. I'm just the messenger.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. It'll be a ton of research, and it'll be interesting to see. But I think that ticket will be a very hot commodity to get in.
Very
so
hot.
Give us your blog and your magazine subscription information for our tagging services.
Okay. Well, the magazine is Plate. It's actually a national, it's a chef magazine. It's an industry publication. And you can go to Plate online for more information on that. My blog is elizabites.com. And that's mostly, like, local Chicago, just kind of things that I love and try and things around town. And I do a lot of traveling.
So anybody who's going to Chicago should have a look at Liz's blog before they go so they know what's
yes.
hot and what's fun to do.
Yes, I definitely. Yeah. I put a lot up there just about.
Yeah, you do.
Know.
It's a really nice blog. I liked it a lot.
Thanks.
Well, we've had a great show. This has been very interesting. We had first Mary Cleaver.
Yeah. And the Cleaver Company with the Green Table and her lovely daughter, Emma.
Really, really
and
cool.
And now Liz Grossberger, who's going to be our regular Chicago correspondent. Liz, we'll probably check back in with you in the next month or so.
Yeah, right? Find out what's new in Chicago.
See, you know, check out what's going on with these new restaurants, new venues, and also just kind of what's the feeling on the ground there as opposed to some of the other cities.
Definitely. Well, a lot going on here, a lot kind of coming, you know, the pike, so it's always.
And Chicago's a great town. So cool.
We're about to come on with Steve Pope, who's going to give us some heritage poultry tips. I hope he's going to mention something about turkeys since everyone's about to get one.
About to happen.
And he's just back from a recent American Livestock Breeds Conservancy conference in upstate New York. So we're not going to be doing a live show next week, but will the week after. So tune back in. And if, you know, you don't hear a broadcast, it's because we went bankrupt with the Turkey Project. So just kidding.
Oh, that's not going to happen, Patrick.
I know, just joking.
Liz, thank you so much for joining us today. And many thanks to our other guest, Mary Cleaver, and her daughter, Emma. And thanks to our producer, Jack Inslee, our engineer, Nat Wiener.
And our sponsor,
and
Cabot
our sponsor,
Cheese.
Cabot.
And also to Cherry Holmes for the music.
So long.
Hey, this is Chef Steve with Good Shepherd Turkey Poultry Ranch. Hey, it's getting close to Thanksgiving, and we're ready. Are you? Have had the last 3 weeks of my life has been a turntable, been running all over the United States, working with Molly O'Neill and helping promote her book, One Big Table, and it is just hitting the market as of the 16th of this month. I was in Ellis Island on the 4th, where we had a very large event acknowledging the book and its first opening for signing, and Molly was there, and we had a grand time. Ellis Island, it was a very eerie feeling to go on that area and to know how many thousands of people had walked through that particular place to become Americans. Molly's book reflects a lot on the heritage and the history of people today. And one of the things that she did during her 10 years of research, two of which I'm proud to say I was a part of, was to look at all the recipes across the entire United States, all the ethnic background recipes, family recipes that have been around for hundreds of years that continue to be a part of the table that people dine at today. There seems to be a resurgence of interest in that area, and we're proud here at Good Shepherd Poultry Ranch to be a part of that. Had a grand time with the activity. Was also spent some time in upper state New York working with the American Livestock Breed Conservancy event. It is their annual convention that was held on November 11th and 12th. What a great experience. I taught a class on heritage cooking, met some very good people, and really enjoyed reliving some of that historical information about how things used to be cooked and how we're learning to recook today. It goes into connection again with this whole thing about one big table. People are taking that much interest. At the event in Hamilton, New York, for the ALBC, there was a lot of education going on about this resurgence and eating healthy, and a lot of things were discussed on a medical, or if you will, scientific level. And there's a lot of things starting to come out, more and more information about you are what you eat and the healthiness that goes with it. Felt fortunate, was able to provide for their banquet dinner. The Good Shepherd people provided the protein or the chicken for the final dinner that we had that night, Saturday night, and we used Bard Rock chicken. I want to thank Chef Greg, Chef Will, and their staff at the Lodge in White Arrow. It was a wonderful example. They just turned their kitchen over to me, and I sure appreciated it, and we had a lot of fun, working with the entire project. I have a lot of things coming up in the future. I'm going to be traveling again, getting ready to do a mandrigal dinner where we'll be using all rare breed and all heritage stock as far as breeds and stuff, and it'll be a fundraiser through the Kansas City Home and Gardens. And we're going to be doing this mandrigal dinner for the Fox Love 4 people that are good at helping other kids. And it's an enjoyable event. Before we even start, I can tell you we're going to have a great time. Also, Thanksgiving, Timmy. Boy, are we ready for that around here. All the turkeys have been sent to market. They should be distributed. And if you, as a listener out there, have purchased one of our birds through Patrick and Heritage Food people, we hope you enjoy that bird. Remember, there are a couple of things that you need to remember when you're cooking the bird so that you'll have a successful outcome, and that is simply low and slow. Take the time to let that bird become what it is supposed to be, and that it's full of flavor. So I ask you that you turn the heat down, brown the bird to start with, then turn the heat down, and I guarantee you, you will not be disappointed. Keep the bird covered until you're ready to brown it again at the end of the cooking cycle. I want to talk to you a little bit about heritage dressing. There's a turkey dressing that we use here and have used for some years, and it really is a very, very good stuffing kind of thing. Now, I prefer not to stuff the bird. I make my dressing outside the bird. I think the bird cooks more evenly that way, but the choice is up to you. Kind of think about this recipe and see if it doesn't sound pretty good for possible stuffing for your Thanksgiving dinner. Take about a pound of heritage turkey sausage. Now, we have that turkey sausage in one-pound packages, and you brown that in about 3 tablespoons of olive oil. Now, that olive oil, once it's cooked down, is not going to have the fats that other fats do, so you're saving a little bit of calories there. Add to that, while it's browning down, some chopped celery and some onions. I like to use yellow onions, mainly because they, to me, have a lot more flavor. The white onions are great for sandwiches, things of that nature, but for cooking, I'll always say let's use yellow. Boil a your liver, gizzard, and necks in about 3 cups of water, and you're creating a stock with that. And getting ready to make the actual dressing, you put in a large bowl, about 20 ounces of breadcrumbs. And if you're doing it the actual old-fashioned way, you take that bread and you put it in, sliced bread in a toaster or in the oven and brown it, dry it out real good, and then chop it up into really fine breadcrumbs. All right, with that 20 ounces of breadcrumb, add about a tablespoon of poultry seasoning. Now, this is commercial poultry seasoning, and you can buy it anywhere. It's just full flavors of sage. What you are looking for is that pronounced flavor of sage in the poultry, along with thyme and a few of the other ingredients. With that, you also add some salt and pepper. Now, you toss that together, and here's the best part of all. You take about 1/4 cup of drippings from the turkey pan, and pour that over the breadcrumbs, mix it together real well, and then slowly start adding your water stock until you get a consistency that you feel comfortable with. Just remember not to add too much water, or again, not enough, because you'll end up with a dry dressing or a too moist dressing, and that may take a little bit of practice. So what you do is put that in the oven. You bake it at 325 for about 30 minutes, and when you're through with that, take it out, uncover it, and again, go ahead and let it brown back in the oven until you get a nice crisp top to it. One of the favorite things is for me to take and eat that crispy top. But I'm usually beat out by a few other people who like to do the same thing. I guarantee if you try that recipe, if you notice there's no eggs in there, you're doing a minimal amount of oil, and you're getting the true flavor of what that dressing should be, and that's part of the turkey. The flavor of the turkey is coming through, and with the sausage, turkey sausage, you're getting a little bit of that nice morning flavor that comes out with a breakfast sausage right along with it. I invite you to have the best Thanksgiving you've ever had. Think about what you're contributing to this world by using Heritage Food Products. By doing that, you continue something that started long, long ago. We hope that you participate with that and have a good Thanksgiving. I'll talk to you next week.